out to be. We'll see what questions we have this evening. One, very good. If the world, the universe, is continually being created by thoughts, desires and aversions, does this have an end point? If so, would all beings have to be potential Buddhas for this to occur with metta? Okay, Buddhist cosmology, this world and universe, the cosmology of Buddhism is very closely aligned to the cosmology of theoretical physics, because I, you know, was a physicist, still keep in contact with physicists and what's going on, and it is well known by most physicists, the prevailing understanding, that this is not the first universe. There's not one Big Bang, but there's been many Big Bangs. If it can happen once, it can happen twice, three times, innumerable times. So as far as physics is concerned, this is just one universe. There's been many other serial universes. I'm not talking about the parallel universe idea, which I never really accepted, and not many people accept in physics either. But the idea of a series of universes, one after the other, when this one runs out of steam, another one can occur. It can because it does because it can. So that means that these universes come and go, and so the beings, you know, come and go into this universe, just like these universes, these bodies are just like the vehicles we just go and inhabit for, you know, our lifetime. So that, yeah, you know, the universe does evolve and devolve as well. But the nice thing about Buddhism, we look upon the stream of consciousness, you know, the spiritual part of the human being, and that also evolves, the theory of evolution of the human stream of consciousness. And so that does have an end point. It's called Nibbana or Parinibbana. That's the end point. So would all beings have the potential to be enlightened? Yeah, of course you have the potential. Not all will, but a lot will. So yes, the world universe is continually being pushed along by, say, by thoughts and desires and aversions. That is, you know, the idea of like human evolution or the evolution of species. Now, why do they evolve from one species to another? And what's the driving force? And, you know, it's quite obvious to me the driving force is the craving, the wanting. Somebody told me they saw a video of like a tree growing. So they took all these photographs of trees, you know, from one position over many days, months, years. And they spread it up so you could actually see what the tree was doing. And when you speed a tree up, it does look like it's going towards the sun, going this way and going that way, and actually fighting other trees for actually the light. And they said it was an amazing video. I haven't seen it, but it's, you know, the trees in the forest, they looked like they were fighting each other. They go so slow compared to our time, you can't actually see it. But when you speed it up, it was actually, they do look really alive. So, yeah, even with plant life, you know, the desire, the craving, is what sort of makes them sort of evolve. Just like you. So we are continually creating. The mind is the creator. And we are interfering with this world much more than people expect. That's why I was saying just that few stories I gave the other night about the ATM machine, somebody's talking about their photocopier. You know, these just actually show just how the mind can influence things. And so if it can influence in a small way, why not in a big way as well? So we do have the ability to create. It's called the law of karma. Anyway, next question. Dear Ajahn, if I don't know how to make more peace, kind and gentle, but as long as I keep my five precepts, is it the same? No, it's not good enough. Just five precepts. Look, even a dog can keep four precepts. usually. It doesn't usually kill. Most dogs, you know, don't kill. Unfortunately, their second precept they're not very good at. They've got no sense of personal property. So they do steal. And they can't commit adultery because dogs don't get married, so it's not everyone for themselves. They certainly don't lie, and dogs don't drink alcohol. So, you know, they've got four precepts. That's not bad. So it's, you can do better than that, surely. So you make peace, be kind, be gentle. It's such a simple thing to do. So you don't fight things. No, we make wars. You know, wars with the people who we live with, wars against nature, wars against, you know, we fight too many battles. And you know what happens when we fight battles and we get divorced, we have arguments, the kids don't like us, they run away from home. And, you know, we make wars with the world and we just blow it all up and destroy it. Now, one nice thing about being a monk, you know, in our tradition is when we do things, we build things ourselves. And if you ever built, you know, like a hut or built a hall or built your house, do you know how much effort and sweat goes into building? You know, the idea that these Jojos just go and blow it up. It's not just blowing up a building, it's blowing up months of hard work. And it's just totally disrespectful for all the energy and effort which went into just building a house. So, having done building myself, these guys who just blow things up and they think they're so great, stop blowing things up. Try and build a place first of all, and then you won't want to blow it up. So make peace and kindness. And surely you can be kind. And just opening the door of your heart just to this moment. And this is a beautiful thing to do. So you get such a big reward back. At last, you don't have to fight the world, you don't have to reject it, you can make peace with it and be gentle. So, I think you don't know how to make more peace. Keep on learning. Learn and learn and learn till you can make so much peace that you have peace of mind. You're so kind that you are really a truly compassionate person and thereby a blessing to the world. You're so gentle, you don't harm anything in this world, least of all yourself. Okay, this next one, no or never doubts. No or never doubts. I don't understand that. I've got doubts about that. But for those of you who do have doubts, because sometimes that, you know, you can go to many different teachers and hear many different ways how to meditate or how to get enlightened. Or sometimes you go to the same teacher and one morning he says one thing, the other morning he says something else. So sometimes it can be very confusing for you. And so I developed a simile, you know, to overcome doubts. And it's a very practical simile. And it comes from a little metaphor, an experience I had many years ago. When, as a young man, I always liked a little bit of solitude. And the only place I could find solitude, you know, living in a country like UK, was to go to the very north, to the Scottish Highlands. And there you could actually go walking in the mountains and wouldn't see another person for maybe a day. Not that long. It's not like going in the bush here in Australia. But I used to love going into those mountains. And one day, I was with the warden of a youth hostel and we climbed one of the mountains. It was a beautiful summer's day. And when we got to the top of the mountain, there was another mountain. I said, I want to go to the next mountain as well. The warden said, oh, you go off by yourself. I'm going back. I've had enough. And that was a very bad thing to do because you should always go with somebody when you're going into the mountains, into the wilderness alone. If you go by yourself, if something happens, there's no one to rescue you. And that almost happened to me because I went up to the next mountain and I never believed the clouds could descend so quickly. And it was up there high in the sky one second, then it just came down and I was enveloped in mist. And it was such thick mist, You know, you could hardly see, you know, if you hold your hand out, you can only just see it. And, you know, I thought, ah, that's not any problem. I know the way I came. I just need to retrace my steps and walk down the mountain. Ha, ha, ha. You always think you have a sense of direction, but you don't. And when I sort of was getting lost going round and round in circles, I did remember some of the stories people have told me. That in that area there was actually two Englishmen like me who had been wandering around for 3 days before they managed to find their way out of the mist. Now, no sleep, no food, no drink for 3 days. And it was pretty tough to get out of there. And I thought I was in big trouble. Fortunately, you know, I used a bit of reason, a bit of logic. I knew that you can go in a meeting and walk round and round and round for days. But all I needed to do was to find a little stream. Because I know that streams don't go round in circles. They go down in one direction only. And so I found a stream and started following the stream, followed it, followed it, followed it, until it got so low down it got under the mist and I could see my directions. And that's how I found my way back. And I use that and teach that as how to overcome your doubts about how to meditate, what's the right path. Because, you know, if it is the correct path, it's going to lead to things like, you know, peace, awareness, happiness, kindness. Now you're going to become more compassionate if you're going in the right direction. You're going to have a greater sense of inner peace. You'll be able to live a life of more harmony, you know, with other people, even those who started to irritate you. If you're going in that direction, you see those qualities are increasing. Congratulations, you are going in the right direction. And soon if you follow that path, you get underneath the mist and you can actually see why it's that correct direction. That's like becoming a stream winner. You understand the path. You have no doubts after that time what to do and how to do it. But until that time, you know, you just got to follow the stream as it goes down. In other words, it's going in the direction which you know the Dhamma should go. So if you're practicing any type of meditation, you're getting more angry. Stupid cushion. Now, why are you not comfortable enough? Stupid hall. You know, stupid everything. Where? Then you're going in the wrong direction. That's not the meditation. If you're getting more tense, that's not meditation. If, you know, you get more frustrated, that's not meditation. So you know what real meditation is by it's going in the direction of qualities like peace, tranquility, clarity, relaxation, you know, the lessening of things like anger, you know, contentment. Those are the qualities, you know. If they're growing, continue on. And thereby you don't need to have any doubt at all. So you don't just believe because, you know, a monk has got a big reputation or a nun has got thousands of followers. Don't just follow the person. Always follow the teachings if it works, then keep on going. That's how to overcome doubts. Venerable sir, could you please kindly elaborate further on what one should expect after seeing beautiful Nimitta? What to expect in the first jhana stage, knowing what to expect might help. It just gets you excited, that's all. Okay, now look, you've got this incredible, beautiful, brilliant light, the bliss. Now, what you're aware of at that particular stage is like this brilliant light. If you ask a person at that stage, well, what were you looking at? What was the object of your awareness? What was happening? And they say, it's incredibly beautiful light. And those nimittas, this is where, you know, you see, if you say it's like a blue light, say, there's all sorts of different lights you can see. The space of blue light. There's a blue which you, excuse me. It's a blue which you can't see in the real world. It's more intense, more deep. If it's an orange, a purple, a gold, And it's not a gold anyone can paint. It's not a gold you'll see in any painting, in any art museum. It's richer, deeper. You know, it's a supernatural gold, you may call it. And that's like a sign of these nimittas, a blue which you can't see in this real world. Blue deeper than any blue. Now that's, you know, the sorts of stuff. But this is actually what you're really aware of. Yes, the bliss is there, but that's more like a secondary phenomena. But the bliss gets so strong that it takes over. That becomes a major phenomena which you are aware of. And so basically you're not aware of the light anymore in a jhana. You know, you're aware of bliss. So if you ask a person who's just come out of the first jhana, say, what was happening? He said, oh, I'm just blissed out. Incredible bliss. And, you know, you ask the other question, well, can you feel your body? Now, you don't know that you can't feel the body while you're in a jhana because you're not really concerned about that. It's off the radar. It's not a question you're even considering. You're just immersed in this beautiful bliss. But when you ask afterwards, you reflect back upon that experience. Now you can relive it, you can get it back up again so easily. And you look at that and say, no, actually there's no physical feeling anymore. And I couldn't hear anything. And you usually know you can't hear things because, you know, people come, people go, you know, they ring gongs and stuff and you just don't know. A example of that, this is one of these nice little anecdotal stories, was of the novice in Wat Pop Hol many years ago. Now I was with Ajahn Chah for 9 years, and obviously he is my teacher, and I respect him enormously, and because I respect him enormously, I can criticize him, you know, because I can put it in context. Sometimes his sermons were incredibly boring and very long, but they were worth sitting through hours and hours and hours of rubbish. Because every so often he'll say something which was just so profound and so inspiring, it was worth it. You guys these days, if you get any of Ajahn Chah's books, they've been edited. All the dross, the rubbish has been taken out. You just get the pearls, the beautiful stuff. You're so lucky. I have to sit through that for hours trying to get something like that. But this was one of those times he was giving a sermon, going on and on and on. Half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. And if you were a monk, it didn't really matter, you know, you had some endurance. But you know, in these temples, they had these little fellows, monks, or rather novice monks, maybe 10, 11, 12 years of age. They go to the monastery because they've either become orphaned, or, you know, the parents can't have the financial means to look after them. So the monasteries became like social safety nets for the kids. So there was one kid, maybe 11 or 12 years of age, sitting through this, and he was getting bored out of his skull. Maybe these monks, you know, they're tough guys, they can handle this, but he's only a small guy. And so he started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? Now you would know that sometimes we get an obsessive thought which keeps repeating itself over and over. And that became one of these obsessive thoughts. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that kept repeating for I don't know how long, until he just had, you know, you call it like an insight. You know, you have something, you see it from a different angle. And he suddenly thought, when am I going to stop? And just that simple thought made him stop. He stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was morning time. The monks had long since gone. He'd been sitting there having the time of his little life, I don't know how many hours. He had not heard the chanting which they usually do before they leave. The Arahang Samma Sambuddho, and the ringing of the gong, and all the monks getting their stuff and moving out, hadn't heard that at all. He was just having wonderful, blissful time, not aware of any of the five senses. He got into a jhana. So this, and the amazing thing was, Why? Because he stopped. He didn't do anything. He did the opposite, stopping. So the idea of stopping is a brilliant, brilliant word. So that gives you an idea of what these jhanas will be like. If you do get into them, you know, yes, sometimes I used to call sometimes ping pong jhanas. You get in, you come out again immediately. It's not really a jhana, we're just tasting it. When you get in, it's usually a long time you stay in there because it's just so still and so beautiful. You know, why the heck come out? You're having a great time. So that's usually a description. So you get some idea of what the jhanas are like. So they can tap you on the shoulder, you know, come on, it's time for lunch. You wouldn't be able to feel it. They could shout in your ear, Abby, Abby, lunchtime. You just, that's like, you know, you're unconscious. You can't hear it. But inside you're having the time of your life. Perfectly aware. But aware not of the five senses. So that's the sort of thing which happens in jhana. There's much more to say, obviously, but that gives you an understanding. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I really appreciate your teachings, really happy now. By the way, what does sadhu mean? It just means, it means like, well done, congratulations, woohoo. Or, you know, just a word of congratulations. You know, it's almost like alleluia. You know, but it is the Buddhist way. Just, it literally means it's good. Well done. I have no basic knowledge about Buddhism. I'm sorry to ask such a basic question. No, it's good. So that's what sadhu means. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm sorry to ask a basic question. Now this is weird. These are different. This happens so often on a retreat. You get two questions almost exactly the same. And these are different writing. I'm sure the people didn't understand this, that they were doing it together. And they always come together in the box. You know, the synchronicity is if somebody has the thought and other people have the thought at the same time and they both write the question. The first question, Dear Ajahn Brahm, sorry to ask a basic question, but what does the sadhu chart mean at the end of the questions and answers? Don't want to miss out on some happiness. Thank you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I appreciate your teaching. Really happy now. By the way, what does sadhu mean? I have no basic knowledge about Buddhism. I'm sorry to ask such a basic question. Now this is not the first time. Every retreat that happens, two or three times, exactly the same question coincides in a totally different handwriting. Dear Ajahn, as one is progressing in one's meditation and is comfortably reaching stages 2, 3, 4 of the lotus petals, is it reasonable to expect to reach these stages quicker in future sittings? I.e., do you reach the middle stages somewhat quicker with experience and practice? Or is it wrong to fast track or speed up to get to the later stages? Now remember, each of these stages, you know, you need the causes and conditions, you know, the work to actually to get there. The simile which I like to use is, you know, that when you get these stages, is of this migrant to Australia who got a job at a building site. And he worked so hard on Monday, all day, and at the end of the day he didn't get paid at all. He came, went back home, and his wife said, how much did you make? He said, nothing, they didn't pay me. He went there again on Tuesday and Wednesday, the same thing happened. Worked all day really hard and never got any money for his work. And he thought, oh, it's a waste of time working in Australia, they don't pay you. You know, so he didn't really want to go to work on Thursday, but his wife forced him, so he went to work and said, look, it's a waste of time, they don't pay you. And he went to work on Friday anyway, because he never had anything else to do. And then at the end of the Friday, the boss gave him a big pay packet, many dollars. And when he went home, he told his wife, I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Friday. On Vedas. Now, of course, you all know that you get paid on Friday for all the work you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday as well. So sometimes you have a very good meditation and you think, wow, now the next meditation will be good as well. Not every day is payday when you go to work. So you may have a very deep meditation. And now you've got to go back and build up some more credits, you know, with your meditation before you can get back there again. So you can't expect every meditation to be a good one. You can't see, I got to the third stage, now I can always have a third stage, and I go to the fourth stage. No, you have to keep on doing some work. And of course that work is letting go, renunciation, making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's your work. If you make enough peace throughout the day, you get so much peace, and then the meditation becomes very deep. You make enough kindness during the day, and then the meditation becomes incredibly powerful. It's not, again, just what you do sitting on your cushions. It's what you do when you're eating. It's what you do when you open the door for someone. It's what you do when you're in line and you know there's only one banana left and you say, no, you have it, not me. That is what creates the beautiful meditations. So this is actually creating peace, kindness, gentleness for every moment in the day. It builds up, and then you have enough money or enough credit, you get the paycheck. That's how it works. How can we keep practicing meditation after the retreat, especially as working mothers? Oh, this is not even close to the end of the retreat. Stop thinking so much into the future. You know, we're crazy people. We can't enjoy the present moment. We're always worrying about what we're going to do 3 or 4 days ahead of ourselves. This retreat might not finish. You might die here. You might get enlightened and become a nun or a monk. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen? So don't keep going off to the future. How can we keep practicing meditation after the retreat? You're not even practicing meditation now. So please, don't go too far ahead of yourself. Dear Ajahn, today I thought I saw a bright light while I was meditating. I did, but it was the sun. Never mind. So if you sit meditation in here, it's very hard to see the sun. It's inside. And this is one of the reasons that I put these windows designed so they're very high up. So there's only a couple of times in the day when you can really see the sun. And if you have any doubts, you can turn around in the opposite direction. Or you put on some shades. The fascinating thing is that the first time people see a nimitta, they are sure it can't be real. They're sure that somebody's shining a flashlight in their face. Or they're sure they're seeing the sun. You're not. I don't know why people don't give themselves the benefit of the doubt that it was a nimitta. They're not that uncommon. And from 10 people tell me they've seen a light. Was it a nimitta? Was it a sun? Was I imagining it? Usually about 95-98% of the time, it's a real nimitta. So well done. What it really shows me is people are so down on themselves. They think that I can't meditate. They think, not me. Maybe somebody else, but not me. Yes, you as well can get nimittas. So, but it doesn't matter. You might saw a bright light when I was meditating. I did, but it was a sun. It could have been Abby taking photographs of you, I don't know. Flash! Yes, nimitta! But nimittas will come sooner or later. Dear Ajahn, what is the science behind the nimittas and jhanas? Chemical reactions, which area of the brain? No area of the brain. He knows jhanas, the brain isn't working, especially the fourth jhana. Okay, another story which is in opening that not, which is in mindfulness, bliss and beyond. This is one of the meditators in Perth. I won't say his name because maybe some of you might even know him. But he came and told me his experience. He was meditating at home on a Sunday afternoon. He'd only usually meditate maybe half an hour, 40 minutes at most. He was bored, nothing on the TV Sunday afternoon. He told his wife, I'm going in my bedroom to have a meditate. So off he went. An hour and a half later, he hadn't come out of the bedroom, so his wife went to investigate. And there she saw her husband sitting in meditation, perfectly still. perfectly still, she could not see his stomach rising. He wasn't breathing. She freaked out and she called 000, which is the emergency number. The ambulance came within 5 minutes and they rushed in. These are trained medics. They looked at him, they couldn't see any breath. They took his pulse, there was no pulse. And so they put him straight into the gurney, into the back of the ambulance. Dee 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 dee, rushing through every red light. Dee 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 dee. Rushing to Charles Gairdner Hospital. That's one of the main teaching hospitals here in Perth. Straight into the ER room. Straight putting the ECG and EEG on his body. Both were flat lines. He was dead. At least most of the doctors would have taken him down to the morgue. But it's amazing what happens in these stories. He was really lucky that the doctor on duty that afternoon, he had migrated from India, or at least his parents had. And he was a Hindu. And he had heard his parents say about meditation that some of these yogis in India can suspend all their life faculties and go into these states of like suspended animation. And he knew from the wife's report that he'd been meditating. There didn't seem to be anything wrong with him. So he gave him another chance. He put on defibrillators onto his body. You know, the electric shocks? Trying to get his heart started again. Apparently, this was according to his wife, there are many, many, many times they tried to shock his heart into action, but still a flat line. Both flat lines. Until, this is what he said, he just decided to come out of his meditation. And as soon as he opened his eyes, beep, beep, all the monitors, the ECG and the EEG, were just going perfectly. And, you know, he opened his eyes, he'd been like, what am I doing? I was in my bedroom, what the heck am I doing in here? He hadn't heard the sound of the sirens of the ambulance, hadn't felt, you know, the medics pick him up, hadn't even felt the electric shocks on his body while they were trying to resuscitate him. And I was saying, well, what were you aware of during that time? He said, the most incredible bliss, the best experience I've ever had in my whole life. It was a jhana experience, a deep jhana experience. And the nice part about it, the reason I say that, is that no brain activity at the time. The EEG was flat. So these aren't chemical reactions. It's nothing to do with the brain. It's everything to do with the mind being totally independent of the brain. Remember, I think I mentioned earlier that this nimitta, this light which you see, everyone, even Christians and Muslims, even the Taliban will see the light. Because when you die, those people who've had near-death experiences floating up out of the body, going towards the light. The light you see when you die is the same as the nimitta you see in deep meditation. Why? Because when you die, the five senses stop. In jhana, the five senses stop temporarily. So it's actually the same thing, the same experience. So that's actually what happens when you get into these deep meditations. Nothing to do with your brain at all. The problem is that we live in a very materialistic world where people think that the mind, consciousness, memory is just some byproduct, some epiphenomena of the brain. And my goodness, as a scientist, I am ashamed that scientists refuse to see the huge amount of evidence, which is huge, it's compelling, and they refuse to see that. They're not being scientific. As Professor Rupert Sheldrake would say, yes, there is scientific method, brilliant, which means you can question everything and you have to base it on evidence. The evidence is there. But not scientific dogma. And there's too much scientific dogma in modern science. And they've forgotten the method, they just have dogma. And with the nature of the brain and consciousness, that is one of the biggest dogmas which is affecting things like medicine, psychology, at least accepting the existence of a mind in psychology, but in medicine that's really affecting sort of many therapies, especially to do with the brain. Why? It's because there's too many egos, too many reputations, too many research dollars caught up in neuroscience. So anyone who suggests that there's something independent of the brain, you're challenging them too much. Anyway, that's another thing. If any of you are interested, Rupert Sheldrake's book, The Science Delusion, is absolutely brilliant. Dear Ajahn, I've heard it said that discipline is important, particularly the discipline of keeping the body still for a long period of time. Please comment. This is what you hear at school. You may hear this in the army, but you know, what is discipline anyway? In the Chinese art of war, there was a general with the best discipline in the whole imperial army. The emperor summoned him. What is your secret? How do you have such perfect discipline amongst your soldiers? And he said, easy. I only tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. That is why they always follow my orders. I only tell them to do what they want to do, so they never disobey. Now, look at that a little bit more deeply. He had to tell those soldiers to get up early in the morning, to train, to go into battle where they get injured or even killed. How could they want to do that? He'd motivated them. He'd convinced them that it was a great thing to do to get up early in the morning. He'd motivated them to make their bodies fit and strong, be able to wield that sword or that bow and arrow. And he had motivated them, maybe through patriotism or service for the emperor or whatever, to go into battle and sacrifice their lives for the cause. They were so highly motivated by this great inspirational general that he just gave the word, charge. And they were just waiting for that, which means they all followed the orders. That is the trick behind discipline. Whether in your company, if you're a manager, whether in your monastery, if you're an abbot, whether in your sort of family, if you're mum and dad, if you motivate people, then you just give them the word and they just want to do it. So my job is to motivate you to meditate. Not discipline you, not order you, not punish you, but motivate you. That is the secret of discipline in all areas of our life. Not fear, which is what many people, second-class people, try to motivate people by fear. If you don't meditate, you are going to go to hell. And if you think it was hot outside today, that's nothing like in hell. And in hell they got these monsters who come up to you in the middle of the night and they bite off your ear. They've got these little bugs who drill into your bone and eat the bone from inside, causing you great pain and agony. They've got these razor trees, you've got to keep going up and down, you get cut to ribbons every time. It's amazing just how many people get into that very sick sort of, you know, wanting to sort of get people afraid. And you go in these temple walls in time, they've got all these pictures of hell and of the heaven, but you find that everybody looking at the hell pictures. The psychology of humans is sometimes we get a fascination with torture. But now that's not the way to motivate people with fear. Motivate them with the other, you know, with inspiration. You get much more discipline out of people than through fear. Dear Ajahn, this morning you said that when you focus on the current layer of the lotus, the next layer will appear. I focus on the body and it disappeared, and the next layer was my past. When I focus on the past, it keeps going on and on and on. If I focus, will the next layer present moment appear? You forgot kindness. It's not just mindfulness, but kindness as well. And if you're very, very kind, I say it softens the past. It's not important anymore. Just like you have an ache or a pain in the body. You focus on it, you're kind to it, and it relaxes until it actually vanishes and disappears. You soften it. One of the problems with the past is because it's so hard. You haven't forgiven it yet. You haven't let it go because it's just too much, too bulky to let go. So if you like, focus and just be soft to it. Now whoever did that to you, be kind to them. Oh, I don't know why they did that. There must have been brain damage, as I said the other night. They must have been in a bad mood. They must have not know what they're really doing. No, so you forgive them. Because when it gets very soft, it's very easy to forgive, to let go, move on, it disappears. Dear Bhante, do you think that the overemphasis on vipassana throughout Buddhist history and the denigration of jhana as the path to enlightenment is due to the erroneous view that jhana was not a unique discovery of the Buddha? There's many questions there. First of all, jhana was a unique discovery of the Buddha. You know, in the suttas it never ever says the Buddha discovered vipassana, but it does say the Buddha discovered jhanas in two places. The Buddha who discovered jhanas, who awakened to jhanas. That's in two places in the suttas. And discovery is a good word, because discovering it was already there, but just grown over. He also said famously, the Eightfold Path, which culminates in the jhanas, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, he said it was like an old path in the jungle to this ancient city, and it had been covered by vines and trees and bushes, and he rediscovered that ancient path, the Eightfold Path. Now that is the idea there, that jhanas, you know, he wasn't the first person. Karma the Kassapa, the Buddha, they were doing jhanas, but he rediscovered it, so it was a path to nibbana. Now, I think the reason why they overemphasize vipassana, and please, you know, I don't mean to denigrate anybody, was because some monks couldn't do it. So because they couldn't achieve the jhanas, they thought, my goodness, I haven't got jhanas. Because the jhanas are so obvious if you have them, or if you don't have them, you can't really sort of get away with saying, well, maybe it was a jhana. These are powerful states of mind. And I think it was the case that some monks couldn't get jhanas. So what am I going to do? I'm supposed to be enlightened, I'm supposed to be wise. So vipassana! I can do vipassana instead. I know even some monks say, oh, even meditation, you can get enlightened just by studying. And then some monks say, no, even studying is too much hard work. You know, I can just, because some people just can't study, they haven't got the brains to study. So just chanting, that's all you need to do. So sometimes you can see that there's some practitioners, you know, because of their ego and conceit, because something they can't do, then they say, well, it's not necessary. So I think that's where it came from. Some people couldn't do the jhanas, so then they try to figure out, oh, it's not necessary anyway. Some people couldn't even meditate, so they say, oh, meditation is not necessary, just study. Some people couldn't study, so they say, oh, study is not necessary, just do chanting. And that's always like just lowering the standard. But you know, it's so obvious. If one of the great benefits of our modern age, information age, each one of you has got full access to all the teachings of the Buddha, the authentic early teachings, and you can know what was the original teachings of the Buddha and what was added on later on. It's so easy to find out these days. 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, you'd ask a monk or a nun, that's the only way you could find out. And sometimes, you know, the truth would be a bit bent because of the monk, you know, didn't want to tell you this or didn't even know themselves. But now everybody knows, and it's so obvious to everybody, that jhanas are absolutely necessary. You can't get away from it. Read it for yourself. And you find that, you know, there's no such thing as just getting enlightened through vipassana. You know, you need the whole Eightfold Path. So that's why that argument is basically lost now, that you can get enlightened just by doing vipassana without jhanas. You can't say that anymore. The evidence is just right out there. Everybody can access it now. Anyway, dear Ajahn, pacifying the sankhara is real happiness. It is in the chanting. Could you explain it more, please?
Esse anichawata sankara upadavaya dhamana upajitawa niyujanti tezang upasamo sukho. Upasama, the word upasama, is a word for settling things down, stilling them. So what we're saying, actually, pacifying the sankharas, it's stilling them. And to get an idea of what that stilling means, the first jhana, the Buddha described it as many types of happiness. And one of those was upasama sukha, the happiness of stillness. That's what you're doing in jhana, you're stilling. What is sankhara? The doer. The most important part of the sankharas, this is from the suttas, but you should know this yourself. The prominent one is chetana, will. That's the most important of all the sankharas, so much so that sometimes the Buddha actually uses chetana for sankhara. This is the creator, the fabricator, the will. And this is why calming the sankharas, or he that had pacifying them, bringing them to stillness, is what we're doing here. Stilling the doer, letting go of the will, not doing anything, making peace, being calm, being gentle. That's what you're doing here. And it gets real happiness. You start getting delightful breath, you start getting incredibly blissful nimittas, you even get an jhana, which is real happiness. So this is actually where it all comes together. You do things, you struggle, you just get frustrated. You've been there, done that. In fact, the only happiness you'll ever get if you struggle is when it comes to the end of the retreat. 9 days are over. Which is why in so many of these retreats, they always take the photograph, the group photograph at the end of the retreat, and everyone is smiling and happy. You know why? Because they're going home now. It's over. God, 9 days. But hopefully that doesn't happen here. Hopefully that during the retreat you get lots of smiles and lots of happiness. And that will only happen if you let go of all this struggling and striving, all this sankharas, all this will, doing stuff, pacifying, stilling the will. It's a tough thing to do. When you get the hang of it, you just stop like that little novice and you bliss out of your head. That's the real happiness. Try it and see. Dear Ajahn, why do I always get images during meditation? It just you've got a visual mind, but you can use images during meditation. These can be what I call the complicated nimitta. So you get an image during meditation. See if you can develop this positive mind so you always go, you're inclined to the most beautiful part of that image. And that beautiful part of the image, the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part. To give you an indication, an anecdote again, I remember meditating some years ago and I got this image of this, this like green paddocks and little river down the bottom and nice trees. But I knew what to do with this. And I was looking for the most beautiful part of this scene, in your meditation. Nice and clear, not hazy, just was there, it was stable. And then I saw on the edge of one leaf a dewdrop. And I knew, yes, I focused on that. You know what I say, you focus on it, everything else on the outside vanishes. And that dewdrop sparkled, like in the sunlight. And that was the beginning of the nimitta. That little sparkle, go right inside it and had this huge big nimitta coming from it. That is how to do this. If you've got a fault-finding mind, then you go to the things which are wrong in that image, the negative part. So this is where the fault-finding mind, which I talk about a lot, don't just think of, what was wrong in this place. I built this place. I know everything which is wrong in this place. Just the speakers aren't right, the walls are boring, and whatever else is wrong with this place.
But that is not the way to enjoy. You know what's wrong with yourself. You can see what's wrong with the nimitta. If you're that type of mind, you'll never get anywhere in meditation. Instead, just what's right, the most beautiful part. Forget about the rubbishy parts. Go for the most beautiful parts of whatever image you have in your mind. You incline towards that, and that becomes more and more beautiful, and you see that, wow, incredible nimittas coming up. Find the most beautiful. And the most beautiful, the most beautiful. The most beautiful, the most beautiful, the most beautiful part of that scene. And then you're on the way. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teaching this morning about keeping the peace and silence in the mind. I had learned from a Vipassana teacher to be mindful by starting, here, now, I am seated. I am not dead, I am not asleep, and I have not fainted. I know I'm alive because I am breathing. Then to watch the breath, I found this encouraged communication in the mind as we had to know everything that came to the mind. Your teaching is helping me to encourage peace and silence instead. Thank you. It is okay to do some noting, have a little commentary at the beginning of your meditation, but please let that go very quickly. Because remember what I said about Lao Tzu, what a beautiful sunset. The word is not what the sunset is. So you may sort of note pain. The word pain is not the experience. You know, it's just an approximation. And it's not a good approximation either. Have you ever gone to the doctor and you said, no, I've got a pain here? What type of pain is it? It's a pain. I mean, there's a thousand different types of pains, but you just don't have the language to describe it accurately. And poor doctors have a difficult time, you know, trying to find out what type of pain it is. And it's just, it pain, it hurts. Yeah, but please explain it. Well, it hurts. How does it hurt? Does it throb? Does it sort of jabbing pain, or so it's so hard because language is so imperfect. So that's why they're noting it's okay in the beginning just to settle you down, but don't go noting all the way. Otherwise, you know, you'd just be just paying attention to the words and not to the thing in itself. My old simile, okay, this one. Here we go. A little exercise for you in insight. What is this? Can you please tell me, shout it out, what is this? Any idea? This is not a trick, this is an exercise. So please, tell me what this is. A gonga, yes, what else? Bit of wood stick, yeah, come on, we're getting some more. What else can you see here? Describe it, give it a name. Yeah, round, yeah, what else? Carved, yeah, what else? Keep on looking. Light, color, brown, just one color, many colors. Shades of brown, heavy, light. Now you know when I'm just forcing you to give it more names. The longer you look, the more you see. If we just stop, this is a gonga, a bonga, whatever it is, and then you stop, you don't look any further. And it's much more than just a gonga. You know, that's the trouble with people. You see, monk, okay, I know, it's a monk. You don't look any further. And that's the trouble with all this noting business. You know, you note and you think, now I know, I've dealt with it, I've captured it, that's all there is, and we never look any further. Keep on looking until you've run out of names. Then you can actually start seeing it. So you go outside, do that little exercise, whatever you go and look at, it might be a stone, it may be a light, you know, it may be sort of, I don't know, what, a little flower, it may be just, I don't know what you might see there, a leaf. Look at it and ask yourself, what is this? And go through your whole vocabulary of names and keep on looking, don't move until you've exhausted all the concepts. And then keep on looking. So you can actually see something without any names. And you can see so much more then. This is not a bonger, it's not a leaf, it's not a flower. It's much more than that. How many times have people given you a name? Stupid. That's not me, I'm much more than that. Maybe that's part of me, but it's much more than that.
Okay, so that's actually what to do there. Better carry on quickly. Dear Ajahn, how to overcome fear when know everything is impermanent? It's everything is impermanent, so you know, who's being afraid? Even the thing being afraid is impermanent. It doesn't belong to you, so you've got no responsibilities at all. That's how to overcome fear. Who's afraid? No one in here. No Ajahn Brahm. There's no Ajahn Brahm to be afraid. There's no Abhi to be killed. There's no Leo to have his head cut off. It's not my head. It's just the head falls off, that's all. So big deal. Whenever you own something, then you are liable to fear when whatever you own is about to be taken away from you. That's exactly understanding what fear is. Things we're attached to are about to disappear. That is the meaning of fear. When you don't own anything, you've got nothing to be afraid of. I don't own it. Hey. So ask yourself what you own. What do you really own? When you realize you own nothing at all, absolutely nothing, then you've got no fear anymore. You've got nothing to lose. Therefore, you're not afraid anymore. That's actually how we usually test if a person's an arahat or not. If they're afraid to lose something like their life, then yeah, they're not an arahat. And they think they own their life, they are their body. So that's usually how we find out who's the real arahat, see whether they are afraid. My story, here we go. There were these series of fires on the buses in northeast Thailand. Now these buses, now you've probably seen some of these in Sri Lanka years ago, or maybe not so long ago. They're so old, they're not maintained at all. They, you know, way past their use-by dates. You wouldn't be allowed anywhere near a road in Australia. They'd be just impounded by the police. They're so ancient, old, and dangerous. And there was a whole series of buses, you know, bursting into flames and people actually being incinerated, because these were very old buses and people would not change them or maintain them. And I even knew one of my friends as a monk was on one of those buses. He had to get out quickly and he lost his bowl, which, you know, he had to leave his bowl inside, and the bus company gave him a new bowl, you know, for sort of out of, was a responsibility. So I was on one of these buses once, and in Thailand you always sit in the front. They're supposed to, you know, protect, you know, you from head-on crashes. They do that. They think if you put the monk in front, then everyone behind is safe. That was Thai tradition. But you know, they are not consistent, the Thais. So when I went on Thai Airways, you know, an economy class, they say, if you put me up front, I will protect you from crashes. They would not upgrade me. Totally inconsistent. It's a good argument though, worth a try. So I was sitting by the window seat, and the aisle seat, another Thai monk, was sitting next to me. And we were going along in around Nong Khai province somewhere, and somebody in the back shouted out, "Fire, fire!" And the bus driver, he slammed on the brakes. Stopped, and he went out, you know, he didn't actually, because of slamming on the brakes, as soon as it stopped, he jumped out the window, you know, because it was really dangerous. And everybody else, they rushed out of the bus, and even the monk sitting next to me, you know, in Thailand, we're not supposed to come into physical contact with women, especially in Thailand. He didn't mind, he was just pushing past the girls. He was out of there. And there was me, I was just sitting there. Sitting there totally calm. And I wasn't the last one out of the bus, because there was two of us left in the bus. There was a man at the back of the bus and me just sitting very calmly. And the man in the back of the bus said, "Oh, it's okay, it's only a cigarette, it's not on fire." And he put out the cigarette and everybody came into the bus. And as they came past me, the arahats, the enlightened, the enlightened. And even the monk said, "Oh, Gengmark, Gengmark," which means, you know, very, very clever monk, good monk. And it was, oh, I felt really good that day.
But it wasn't lack of fear, it wasn't bravery, it was just plain old stupidity. I didn't read the newspapers, I didn't know all these buses had blown up. I didn't know when they started fire what was going on, I was just sitting there stupid. So be careful, sometimes stupidity can be very easily seen as lack of fear. It's good when it lasted anyway. Anyway, next question. Ajahn, as I was sitting, my mind started to spin and my body would spontaneously rock every few minutes, which jerked me out of the stillness. When I got up for breakfast, I was disorientated, and when lying down, I'm floating. Please comment on this and other unusual experiences in meditation. That's called Elvis Presley meditation. Rocking and rolling. Enjoy it. Bit of rocking and roll during the meditation makes it interesting. Okay, you're stilling the mind, the body would spontaneously rock every few minutes. Now, there is a serious part to this, is that please, you know, try and do the meditation according to, you know, as I'm instructing you. Get to the breath. Focus on the breath when you're meditating, and put all the energy onto the breath until the breath vanishes and then the whole body vanishes. Because what happens sometimes, if you don't follow the right path, and you get still too quickly without going through the breath, some of that energy just goes into your body. It should be going into the mind. So if the energy goes into the body, that's when you go rocking around and doing weird stuff. It's not bad, it's not sort of dangerous, but you know, sometimes it's a bit unpleasant and weird. And all it is, the energy, you know, is the mental energy which should be staying in the mind is leaking into the body. You know, causing you to rock and do weird stuff. So please, next time, you're getting still, you're getting some energy coming up, well done. But next time, be still and become aware of your breathing. And if you become aware of your breathing just that much, the whole of the rest of the body vanishes. You just don't know what's happening to your head. You don't know if you're rocking or not. Because you can't perceive the rest of the body, energy can't go there. It just stays into the breath, and your breath becomes so delightful. Your breath becomes energized and beautiful. Now when that disappears, you know, you get these limiters, the energy is going into the mind. It's not going into this body. So that's, you know, the underlying reason there. So please get into the breath as soon as you can. The rest of the body, let it vanish and disappear. That's also why don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose. Watch the breath, not the nose. Because if you have body awareness, if energy comes up, the energy stays in the body and causes all this weird stuff. Ajahn Brahm, there is a man conducts meditation lessons in Sydney and Canberra using a flowchart. He claims the flowchart was given to him by a great Brahman god, Sakya, explains sutras using his chart. Followers say some of has gone to heaven or hell. Is that not delusions? Yes, 100%. I've seen those. But why are you so gullible? You know, you see this stuff. Check it in the sutras, what the Buddha said. Instead of people saying he was given these things by a god or Brahmin or Sakya or something. Oh, sorry to waste your time, but he cheats many people, yeah. In the spiritual world, there are a lot of cheats around. So check them out. Be suspicious when you see these. Especially if you see gurus giving the quick way. The quick way which has just been revealed. Now, by some god or by some person just recently, not the old way of the Buddha. That's no past issues by day. That takes too much time. This is a quick, easy way. And it only costs you $1,000. If there's money involved, please be extra suspicious. Because, you know, when we teach for nothing. You know, we teach just to give. All the teachings I received, Ajahn Chah never charged. The Buddha never charged. So that's why, you know, we should never charge for teachings. Just give. And then if people want to give donations, fine, but not charge for things. So this is one of the reasons why I be careful of people like that. It's just sometimes, you know, they are deluded. Sometimes they're a bit schizophrenic. Sometimes they have these visions they don't understand. And they write them all down. They don't know what they're doing. So be careful. Venerable sir, could it be the only reason for our defilements to arise, kalesas, is a deep-rooted fear of annihilation? That is one reason. For example, a country steals water from another country may look selfish and greedy on the surface, but deep down may lie the collective fear of annihilation. If this may be so, does it make sense to get rid of this well-hidden, unknown, and experienced fear first in order to overcome our defilements? That's very true, you know, the idea of like losing yourself, but instead of losing yourself, I like to say losing control. Because one of the most essential parts of your of who you think you are, you know, is your ability to control, to call the shots, to decide what you eat every morning, when you go to bed, decide what you wear. You know, all of that you think is, you know, your birthright, your self-determination, you know, your will, your freedom to choose. That's enshrined in many, many parts of human rights conventions. But you know, later on I will challenge that to the basis. Now, are you really in control, or are you brainwashed and conditioned? Why do you have your hairstyle like you do? Why do you wear the clothes you do? When I was a young man, I saved up some money and I got my green velvet trousers. I remember my green velvet at about 19 years of age. And I thought I was unique. I had my green, I was making a statement. You know, of who I was, being a rebel. And then I went to this big rock concert down the Isle of Wight, and I found there was about 1,000 other people with green velvet trousers. It was just another uniform, that's what it ended up being. I thought I was individual, but I wasn't individual. You know, I was just following a trend. And that, you know, those sorts of things shock you. Now, did you really have free choice? Or was it really conditioned? But I'll go into that a bit later. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it okay to just meditate in your room rather than the hall? One minute it seems like that is okay, the next minute it seems not. No, of course you can. You can meditate wherever you want in this compound. You can even meditate on the toilet. I think some people do, because sometimes the toilet is engaged for such a long time. I think people must be meditating there, because if you meditate on the toilet, at least you understand what letting go means. So you can meditate wherever you want in this compound. So, yeah, you can meditate here, you can meditate in your room, you can meditate wherever. Lastly, dear Ajahn, what is a nimitta? Please explain. Okay, just in brief, because I will give a whole talk on nimittas, I promise, as long as I remember. Trouble is, when I promise things, I say, well, no, that's about the future, forget about the future. And when I sort of think, I promised about giving a nimitta talk, then I think that's the past, let go of the past. So that's why I don't keep the promises. It's not because I'm dishonest, it's just because of the Dhamma of letting go. But anyway, what is the nimitta? It's what happens when the five senses start to disappear. It is the time when you are aware of this thing we call the mind, sometimes in Pali called the citta. That's what it is. It is the citta, your mind. And this is the way that people usually perceive it, as a light. If the five senses are really subdued, then the nimitta is very clear. If you've got a lot of good precepts, sila, goodness, you know, pure heart, then that nimitta is very powerful. So this is where you first see, you know, your jitta, this thing called mind. That's what it is. And that's why this is a great way of meditating, because this is where you find out, you know, who's the emperor? This knower, this doer, what is this thing? Now you can actually see it, it's this beautiful light. So that's what it is, but I'll tell you more about that later on. I don't want to give all the secrets this evening, otherwise there'll be nothing left to talk about tomorrow. So episode 2 of the Nimitta, to find out who really did it, who was the culprit, we'll find that out in another talk. Another. Remember, they used to have these series. I used to go through Saturday morning pictures when I was a kid. And you always have, you know, Batman or some other hero. And he'd always be left. And he was just dangling, you know, down the cliff. And you didn't know how he was going to survive. So you had to go next week to find out episode 2. So this is what I'm doing now. Find out. Oh, more about the nimitta, coming soon in a meditation center close to you tomorrow. So that's enough for this evening, because I've gone on long enough. It's 9:15 and some of you need to go to bed. So here we go. Sadhu. 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 Don't always do it the same way. Always do it different. Don't be a creature of habit. Innovate. Get energy, happiness, joy. Okay, and have a good night's sleep. Very good. So when you first wake up in the morning, please jump out of bed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. At 3 o'clock in the morning, okay? Don't do that. You don't want to be complaining. Oh, they woke me up.